Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
I'm Dave.
And today we're welcoming back George Fritsma. So, George, welcome back. We're happy to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, today George is going to talk about hemophilia. So, first, we're going to start out and talk about how we used to treat hemophilia back before we had more of our new novel therapies that we have now. So we first identified hemophilia in the second century. Then we killed its victims in infancy. Then the evil monk Rasputin employed the occult to assist hemophilic Prince Alexis and the Romanovs, triggering the Russian Revolution. And by the 1970s, hemophilia was cured until the therapy was found to transmit fatal viral diseases. This led us to recombinant extended half-life factor VIII and factor IX that required special management. Then we ended up with emicizumab and then rebalancing and gene therapies. So how has the lab managed these changes? There's a lot. So George, why don't you tell us a little bit about how all of this happened and how the lab responded as we went?
Thank you, Melissa, and thanks, David, also. If you can find a copy of a book entitled Journey, published in 1993, and it's out of print, Susan and Robert Massey, who are also the authors of the Romanovs, books about the Romanovs in Russia, they had a son, Bobby, pictured here. Robert Massey III, he's now an Episcopal priest. He was born with hemophilia. And every time that he had a bleed, they had to rush about 30 miles to the nearest hospital to the emergency room where he would be given fresh whole blood. That's all that was available. That was before 1960, and it was a difficult time for hemophilics in general. Now, in 1962, something called the cone fraction, which had really been developed in the 40s and was a crude form of anti-hemophilic factor, was used for a young man who had appendicitis, and it worked. It was successful. Then in 1966, Dr. Judith Poole at Stanford, this is Dr. Poole over here, developed a cryoprecipitate. And actually, when I was in the Air Force in 1968 through 72, I often had the opportunity to prepare cryoprecipitate. It's still being used, and cryo is not easy to make. Actually, you have to take a plasma, you have to take a frozen plasma, thaw it slowly, and then a thin film, white film, will appear at the top. And then you express that out and freeze that, and that's your cryoprecipitate. At the time that they were using it, it was used only to provide factor VIII to care for hemophilia. But cryo also has a lot of von Willebrand factor and fibrinogen in it, and it's still being used. Now, in 1968, Dr. Kenneth Brinkhouse at North Carolina produced and had commercialized what was called in those days anti-hemophilic factor or anti-hemophilic globulin. We now call it factor VIII. And that was commercialized. Unfortunately, it was so expensive that the Masseys couldn't use it, and they had to move to France for 4 years in order for Bobby to get the anti-hemophilic factor that he needed. But by 1973, they were instrumental in helping form the NHF. And the NHF developed centers for therapy. And shortly after that was done, Medicare and Medicaid took over the dispensing of the anti-hemophilic factor. And in 1980, now anti-hemophilic factor cared for hemophilia A or people who were lacking factor VIII. And by 1980, there was no factor IX concentrate, but something called prothrombin complex concentrate, which actually had in it 2, 7, 9, and 10, and that was used for hemophilia B. Also, in around 1980 or shortly after, an activated form of PCC called FBA, that stood for factor VIII inhibitor bypassing activity, was used if the patient had developed inhibitors. So by 1980, we'd reached a golden age of hemophilia therapy because now the hemophilics could actually keep the antihemophilic factor in their refrigerator, and whenever they felt a bleed coming on, they could infuse it and stop the bleed. And so their life expectancy by the age of 60 was by the yeah, their life ex excuse me, I should say their life expectancy averaged around the age of 60. The only problems were that there was no viral activation at the time, and the concentrates might have as many as 20,000 donors per pool. And so there was a high rate of hepatitis because you can imagine the risk of among 20,000 people that one or two might have hepatitis. So that then 1980 therefore represented the just the peak of hemophilia therapy. Now, next, you might ask, how did the lab monitor the hemophilia therapy at that time? And we had developed in the 1970s a partial thromboplastin time test for monitoring tests for monitoring factor VIII and factor IX levels. That was the clot-based procedure. We would make a standard curve and then measure the level of factor VIII in patient plasma after that standard curve. Generally, we would use it at 4 hours after the infusion and then again at 24 hours after infusion. And what we used was shortened to the one-stage clotting assay, or OSA, and that was commonly used at that time. So, well, it seems like everything was going well. What happened in 1980? In 1980, cases of pneumocystis cranii pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma were being diagnosed in gay males. A lot of work went into trying to figure out what was going on, if this had to do with sexual practices or some of the drugs that might be used. But by 1981 and on to 1982, the CDC reported AIDS transmission with blood products. And they went public with this information and created a really ugly public debate in which several people complained that the CDC was publishing information that was discriminatory towards homosexual people. Dr. Bruce Evatt was the president of CDC at the time, and he named the condition acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, or AIDS, and nobody really knew what was going on. Now, he had recommended, he had actually he had demonstrated six cases in which AIDS had been transmitted by transfusion. And so he had recommended that donor services would screen donors for sex orientation, thinking that AIDS was only seen in gay people. Well, this wasn't such a popular idea. He had brought the idea to, oh, the AABB, to Red Cross, to several community organizations supporting gay people, and they all really climbed on him for doing that. Nevertheless, by December of 1982, one of the companies, one of the Donor processing companies, Alpha Therapeutics, began to screen donors using discrete questionnaires. They still do something like that today. It's been a year or so since I've donated blood, but they give you the opportunity in private to tell people if you have engaged in any risky sexual practice. In March of 1983, Evatt made everybody mad by bypassing the FDA altogether and sending guidelines to the U.S. Public Health Service and the National Hemophilia Foundation that had been formed in 73, developed a donor questionnaire, and there was no testing for the causative organism at the time. In fact, they didn't actually identify it till later in 1983. So they used surrogate hepatitis marker testing, since the infection, the AIDS, what appeared to be an infection, followed closely the incidence of hepatitis marker positivity. Now, in 1983, at the Pasteur Institute in France, the organism was identified and named HIV by Professor Luc Montagnier, and he won a Nobel Prize for his work in 2008. And by the end of, well, by March of 1983, Baxter Hinland and other plasma treating or companies began heat treating the plasma. By August of 1983, there were now 26 confirmed cases of transfusion-transmitted AIDS, including one with a factor IX deficiency. And by 1985, the number of deaths caused by HIV was the worst worldwide epidemic before 2020. In 1985, when testing became available, and when screening became available, there were no more deaths associated with blood or plasma transmission. But because of these problems, and because the technique known as hybridoma had been established in the 70s, there were molecular companies that were incorporated, Genentech and Genetics Institute. Genentech in 76, Genetics Institute in 1981. By 1982, they had cloned a factor IX gene and produced recombinant factor IX. Factor IX is a smaller molecule than factor VIII and was easier to produce. And so that was already cloned by 82. And by 84, both companies had cloned a factor VIII gene, reproduced a recombinant factor VIII, but the yields were small and were finally improved when they co-produced von Willebrand factor to bind to the recombinant factor VIII. It went through a lot of testing. One other a recombinant material insulin had been produced at the same time, but the use of recombinant factor VIII and recombinant factor IX created a lot of uncertainty, and so over 600 tests per lot had to be done to check for sterility and the consistency and the effectiveness of the recombinant factor VIII and factor IX. But by 1993, an extremely short time to market from the time that things got started, Genentech, with support from Bayer, produced Cogenate, and it's still available and is still being produced. Actually, back in 1987, Ken Brinkhouse, the guy who originally had developed anti-hemophilic factor at the University of North Carolina, had successfully used during a phase two study the concentrate in a 39-year-old hemophiliac who was near death from bleeds, and actually rescued him at that time. Anyway, so 93, that's when the Cogenate was produced, and then also in 92, Recombinate was produced, and this is now distributed by Takeda. And however, both of these were cultured in human serum albumin. That was the matrix in which they were produced, which implied that there was a risk of viral transmission. The implied risk was of concern. The reality was that there were no data that showed that HIV or even hepatitis were transmitted through these recombinants. However, that risk did exist. But now we had the recombinant materials, which could be produced in great volume, and lab monitoring was still performed using the one-stage clotting assay, which was as good as it was for the plasma-derived factor eight and plasma-derived factor nine. That's not to say it was great. The CVs for the one-stage clotting assay were fairly broad when tested by CAP surveys. Nevertheless, it was a short time to market, and this was all new technology by Genetics Institute and Genentech. Well, that wasn't the end. First of all, it was important that the hemophilia treatment after about 2001 or 2002 migrated from using the plasma-derived factor 8, factor 9 to now what was abundant, recombinant factor 8, factor 9. And they were using ReFacto, which was prepared in human serum albumin and was just discontinued last year. Genetics Institute developed Benefix factor 9, recombinant factor 9, and it was not prepared in serum albumin and is still being distributed. That was actually became available back in 1998, and Pfizer is still distributing that. The therapy migrated in 2000. All the hemophilics were using on-demand therapy. That meant that they would only infuse themselves when they began to feel a bleed coming on. I'm told, I understand, I had a friend who was hemophilic, and he said, "You would know that a bleed was starting within minutes of when it started, and within 30 minutes, the pain would be unbearable, especially if it was bleeding into a hip or the knee." Became unbearable. And so these boys had to have access to the concentrates, and they had to treat themselves immediately when a bleed started. They also had a fairly high annual bleed rate. But the therapy migrated from on-demand to prophylaxis, and nearly everybody now uses prophylaxis, and that means they would infuse themselves two or three times a week. So these boys would get up early in the morning before going to school, and they would infuse themselves with one of the recombinant factor eight or factor nine. And they would have to do that two or three times a week. Another thing that was happening was that for reasons that I won't go into here, fairly technical reasons, it became apparent that the recombinant concentrates actually doubled the risk of the formation of an inhibitor over the plasma-derived concentrates. And so, in an effort to resolve this, several of the producers developed B-domain deleted factor 8 or BDD. This is a factor 8. This is just a little diagram that shows what a factor 8 molecule might look at. And the B domain is a large section in the middle that has no epitopes that are of importance in coagulation. And so it could be removed and then it could be shortened. And the theory was that because it was a shortened molecule, it would reduce the production of inhibitors. Didn't work. It still is a risk. There still is inhibitor production. But later work has shown that the inhibitors that are produced are, for the most part, fairly weak, and so are clinically of some concern, but not a great deal of concern. So by 2003, Takeda had developed Advate. It's not produced in serum albumin, and it's B domain deleted. And Wyeth, now Pfizer, produced Xyntha 2008, and that's also B domain deleted. Now, one of the problems with the B domain deleted products is that the one-stage assay results don't necessarily match the computed plasma levels. And so at that time, because you pretty much couldn't trust the one-stage clotting assay, there was then a development of the chromogenic substrate assay. Chromogenic substrates were developed at that time for measurement of factor VIII and factor IX, and they gave better accuracy. In doing this presentation, I've used a few names of a few of the products. There are more products that are available, and Dave McGlasson, who is also one of Melissa and David's presenters, has on his Clot Club, which appears on the Diapharma website, a complete and exhaustive list of all of the recombinant and plate and plasma-derived factor VIII and factor IX concentrates. So if you need further information on all the concentrates, I recommend that you go there. So that brings us up really to 1994. So from 2003 until about 1994, we had moved from plasma derived to recombinant factor VIII and factor IX. We moved over from on demand to prophylactic therapy, and we moved to mostly B domain deleted factor VIII. That didn't really help much with inhibitors, but it will become important as we see what's happened next. So I will turn it back over to Melissa and ask if you guys have any questions.
Thanks, George. That was great.
Yeah, it seems like the Wild West of treatments for a while, huh?
It's gotten worse.
That's not what I want to hear, George.
Yeah. Well, it's gotten better in many ways, but
Sure.
we'll look at some of the new things that are happening in the next presentation. So, anything I missed or anything that you're wondering about?
I don't have any questions or comments, Dave. Do you?
No, I and honestly, this is a space that I'm an observer here. I haven't acquainted myself with many of the products, especially some of these more historical things here. But it's incredibly interesting to see the evolution of the geez, I mean, how we got from A to B. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing that I like to point out, and I meant to point out, and that is that while you could say we've moved completely from plasma derived to recombinant, in the world, that's not true. In many parts of the world, some of which are under-resourced and some of which simply function on a more traditional level, even though they have resources, the plasma-derived materials are still being used, and on-demand therapy is still used. Particularly, on-demand therapy is used a lot in under-resourced areas because the cost of prophylaxis is much greater.
I can imagine that, this is a very expensive product. I think that's the other. If I had a question, right, what is the relative cost of some of these later products compared with a more traditional, modality?
Product by product, I don't have an answer for that, and that those answers are a little hard to come by. However, it's estimated that if a hemophilic lives 60 years, he will have consumed about $20 million in products.
That's
And
sort of the I was looking for that scale, and that certainly gives me that scale. Yeah, that is immense.
it's huge, and that's an average, of course, because usage is one thing I did fail to mention that's in my slide is that when we went to prophylaxis instead of on demand, the annual bleed rates dropped by 90%. So you're paying more for product, you're paying less, you're not going to the hospital 40 times a year to handle, a severe bleed.
Oh,
So it
yeah, I
was.
would imagine that prophylactic treatment would be much more expensive, but that's a fair point too, right? That the ER visits and general interventional medicine is going to be lower, and so there's a cost reduction there as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. And so overall, besides simply from a humane point of view, the boys are much happier and not having to deal with these bleed rates all the time. And in fact, when I was a child, I lived next door to the school. I was probably 7 or 8, and I remember during recess, there was one boy in my class who never came out for recess. And I remember asking my mother about it. She said, "Oh, he's a bleeder." And now, with prophylaxis, these boys can really engage in physical activities, probably not football, but many other physical activities with a much lower risk of a bleed.
Yeah, so normalization of life is like a huge thing here, right?
And it's worth that. And much of the expense is really covered through Medicare and Medicaid.
That's good.
Okay, good.
No, it's wonderful. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate you coming on to give me some background here, especially for some of us who maybe like, so I didn't really work much in special coag. And I didn't deal with a lot of these products and things like that, so it's a good background.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, and I think that's
Absolutely.
the end of my talk, and I'll turn let you whatever you have to do to walk me out.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And well, we're looking forward to part two so we can talk more about the newer, even newer updated products that we have. But George, thank you for coming on and sharing this with us, and everybody else, thanks for watching.
Okay.
Thanks for
Okay.
your time.
Thank you.